The Science Inside Podcast.
This is the Science Inside.
Good evening and welcome to the Science Inside. This is the show that brings you the latest news and events happening in the world of science and technology. I am your host, Bridget Lebere, and in this week's show, we are talking about genetics. Yes, genetics, which are the origins of each and every individual in the world. And this is what makes individuals unique, and our DNA holds many, many clues to what an individual has inherited from their parents, and which of those traits do they share with their siblings, and of course, which of those are they likely to transfer to future generations. And why we are talking about genetics today, it is because genetics are the biological database of our individuality. Now, our DNA also is able to inform of the kind of diseases one is susceptible to, and this makes genetics an increasingly compelling science to look into, and there's a need for precision medicine which is custom made and built to communicate very well with our genetic makeup or our structure. Now, a research team in the Sydney Brenner Institute for Molecular Bioscience, in short SBIMB, at the Wits University, are currently investigating some of the biggest and most compelling questions regarding modern science, with the aim to contributing to one or more of science goals with a focus on sub-Saharan African populations. Now, the institute is a multidisciplinary research institution dedicated to investigating the molecular and genomic etiology of diseases among African populations, and they have developed an application from scratch, and tonight we discuss their interesting innovation, a genetics app which was created by four Wits postgraduate students, namely Mahtab Hayat, George DeRosha, Heather Seymour, and Natalie Smith, and they aim to inform and educate young people through this innovation, and all this and more a bit later in the show. And of course, we on social media, our handles are Facebook. On Facebook is The Science Inside, and you can get in touch with us on our WhatsApp line on 084-078-4912. You can also tweet us and have a conversation with us at VowFM hashtag Science Inside. But obviously, we will look more into these stories a bit later. And now we go into our news making headlines tonight.
This week's Science Headline.
A new research finds a lot of unnecessary medical of prescribing of antibiotics in South Africa, and the University of Pretoria scientists capture the first image of the black hole. Good evening. I am Bridget Lebere with your Science Inside News. 3/4 of patients sent to doctors and clinics in South Africa were prescribed antibiotics apparently for no reason, a new study has found. The study was conducted by researchers from the University of the Witwatersrand and London School of Economics and Political Science, who sent undercover patients to 186 private general practitioners and 73 public clinics. Before going incognito, the mystery patients weren't sick at all, apparently, and they received intensive training to make sure they all tell the same story to the doctors. So, Masibulele Lunika spoke to Dr. Duane Blau, a senior researcher in the Center for Health Policy in the Wits School of Public Health, who co-presented the findings recently, to tell us more about the research and what inspired it and how it was conducted.
The study wasn't in hospitals. It was actually with primary care providers. So that was, it's with nurses working in public clinics and with private GP. And we were trying to understand something about how much unnecessary antibiotic prescribing is happening in primary care. There hasn't been a lot of research in primary care. Most of the research is in hospitals. So we used quite an interesting method called standardized patients. And that's also one of the sort of novel things about the study, because there hasn't been a lot of research in South Africa on using standardized patients. They're seen as a good method for trying to evaluate quality of care. So what we do is we send field workers that we have trained to present a clinical case. So they go as patients to public clinics and to private GPs. And then when they're there, they present a particular clinical scenario. So they give a particular history and they are trained to answer specific questions. So our standardized patients were trained to present this case of somebody who's recovering from a cold but now has a cough. But they were all young, healthy people and no evidence of anything serious, so no pneumonia or something like that. So they were all completely healthy. So none of them should have got antibiotics. And then what we did was we evaluated whether or not they were given an antibiotic when they presented with this story, both to the public sector and to the private sector. So the main findings of the study that were in the release, the main results were that in the public clinic, 78% of our standardized patients were given an antibiotic when they don't need it, and by private GPs, it was 67% were given an antibiotic, any antibiotic.
According to Dr. Blau, these findings lead to dire consequences in healthcare, including what is known as antibiotics resistance in times of real need.
It's true, you know, lots of very resistant superbugs, and also lots of antibiotics are used, particularly for sick people. In fact, the majority of antibiotics are actually given in primary care. And so one of the big problems is when antibiotics are given when they're not needed. And one of the big problem areas is what we call respiratory tract infections, you know, like colds and ear infections and throat infections. Most of those are caused by viruses. So antibiotics don't work, because antibiotics only work against bacteria. And when you use antibiotics in people who don't need them, that drives a selection pressure to create sort of mutations that result in antibiotic resistance. So this unnecessary use of antibiotics, particularly for respiratory tract infections like a cold or something, is one of the big problems in driving the resistance of bacteria to antibiotics. And that's a big public health problem, because we're running out of drugs that we need to treat people when they need antibiotics, and that's not needed. So the problems around that are, as we've said, it drives antibiotic resistance, but it also has other problems, like it's a waste of resources and a waste of money. And it's not just about respiratory tract infections. It could also be about other drugs, you know, sexually transmitted infections, urinary tract infections, brain infections. All of these are important infections that we need antibiotics. And if you get infected with one of those, you might it might be a resistant strain, and it has nothing to do with whether or not you've individually had antibiotics before. So it's at a population level that these problems develop.
In our second story, two scientists from Pretoria and Rhodes Universities are among a groundbreaking group of international researchers behind capturing the first ever image of a black hole. The image shows the black hole at the center of Messier 87, a massive galaxy in the nearby Virgo galaxy cluster. This black hole resides 55 million light years from Earth and has a mass of 6.5 billion times that of the Sun. Taken by the Event Horizon Telescope, EHT, a global scientific collaboration involving EU-funded scientists, the image provides visual evidence for the existence of black holes and pushes the boundaries of modern science. The breakthrough was announced by the EHT consortium last week in a series of six papers published in a special issue of the Astrophysical Journal Letters. Professor Roger Dean from the University of Pretoria's Department of Physics and his postdoctoral fellow, Dr. Inian Natarajan, from Rhodes University's Department of Physics and Electronics, help build a highly realistic simulation of the Earth-sized EHT instrument that enables astronomers to better understand real observations, discriminate between theoretical black hole models, and provide insights into the characteristics of the telescope itself. The EHT collaboration involves more than 200 researchers from Africa, Asia, Europe, and North and South America. It links telescopes around the globe to form an Earth-sized virtual telescope using the same technique as the African Very Long Baseline Interferometry Entry, VLBI in short, network, but a much higher frequency, enabling an even sharper view of black holes. Supermassive black holes are a prediction of Einstein's general theory of relativity, and this first image of the black hole shadow has been announced during the centennial year of the historic experiment that first confirmed this theory. Dean and Natarajan's contribution is supported by the University of Pretoria and by a grant awarded to Rhodes University, which is funded by the Department of Science and Technology and the National Research Foundation. Recapping your top stories this hour, new research finds lots of unnecessary medical prescribing of antibiotics in South Africa, and the University of Pretoria scientists help capture the first ever image of the black hole.
That was quite interesting, right, Masibulele? I mean, with antibiotics, if you do overprescribe them, we do know that you can't develop antibiotics resistance. And at a time when you may really, really, really need those antibiotics, they may not work.
Incredibly, incredibly amazing discovery. I just admire the way in which they went about researching these findings. If you imagine people going undercover and actually surprising doctors of God and actually discovering this huge thing. And it's actually a practice that's apparently been happening. And it raises quite a need for concern when you see, of course, the consequences now of people then having now resistance to antibiotics, because then in times of real need, then it becomes a real issue.
Yeah,
definitely.
But anyway, we do not have much time left, really. We do still have much content to go through. So we are going to jump right into our first story. And our first story is on the genetics app that was created by Vitsi students. And this is really a novel, idea. Yeah. And a novel creation, right?
I fully agree. And it's always nice to see students coming up with these innovations.
Yeah, because I mean, an app to teach young people, especially people who are just glued to their LCD screens, yeah, all day long. So what a great way to educate them by looking at that blue screen that we all love. Parents don't really like that blue screen.
Yeah, no, mine definitely don't.
What, are you one of those people?
I'm one of those kids
who are always on their phone, and then when you scream them out and you're like, Masibulele, you don't hear
you'd have to scream at least 100 times.
Yeah, I really don't like that. But anyway, four postgraduate students at the University of Sydney Brenner Institute for Molecular Bioscience, SBIMB in short, and the Division of Human Genetics in the School of Pathology run the VITS Human Genetics Outreach Program. And they have developed this genetics app to help South African learners and citizens at large to understand genetics and what actually makes them unique. So Scope, as they call themselves, is a genetics. The genetics app was launched at the African Society of Human Genetics meeting in Rwanda. in September last year. And we found out about this app and from its two creators, the chairperson of Scope, Mahtab Hayat, and the secretary of Scope in the app development team, George DeRosha. So it was quite impressive how, you know, when they presented this app, everybody in Kigali apparently wanted this app, and they actually wanted the app to be translated in these languages from all over the world. But obviously it's a South African app. It would need to be translated to our other 10 official languages. So right now it's still in English. But obviously in future they would like to
expand it.
Yeah, to expand a bit more on it. So I think for now let us just take a quick break and then thereafter we can return with more on the story.
This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back to the Science Inside. This is it. And before we went into the break, we were talking about an app, a genetics app, which was launched in Kigali last year in September by Vitsi students. And we find out more from Mahtab Hayat, who is the secretary of SCOP, and the George DeRosha, who is who worked on the development of the app. And here in the following clip, they go into how this app actually came about.
Our outreach program decided to design an app that would be easily accessible for all ages, for all types of people everywhere in the country. Our main aim was to mainly make it accessible to underprivileged schools, because once you download the app, you don't need any data or internet access to use it. So we were hoping it could be used as a tool.
My name is George DeRosha. I'm here at the SBIMB as well, and I'm doing my PhD here, and I'm the secretary for Scope and on the app development team. So how this app came about is it was a wonderful project inspired by our school learners. We visit schools and we give them a rundown of how DNA works, what it can be used for, how it affects our health and other traits. And we found that the learners were often left wanting more, and we wanted a way to reach them outside of our own visits. And we figured every learner nowadays has a cell phone in their pocket and they spend more time looking at that than their own books. So why don't we develop an app to reach them from that point of view too?
Now, this group realized that there was a knowledge gap in schools with regards to how biology and genetics is learned at schools, and they realized that if they were to tackle the educational deficits as far as genetics are concerned, they would be well on their way to debunking myths and misconceptions one child at a time. And here they're going to educating on misconceptions around genetics.
We hope that the app could help eradicate certain myths surrounding genetics and inheritance. For instance, a very simple one would be, in a lot of cultures, the woman gets the blame for giving birth to a boy or a girl. So the app could help educate communities on the fact that it's not actually the woman's fault, it's actually the man's fault, because his sperm decides whether it's an X or a Y, or a female or a male. Also, things concerning albinism and other traits that may cause a lot of issues in communities. But we're also hoping that it would help students who are studying genetics, particularly in grade 11 and grade 12, because the app starts from a very basic overview, which is what you do in high school, to a more broader world-based overview and how genetics applies in the world.
I think everyone has an inherent question about DNA. DNA is where we come from, why we are like who we are like, and we all got it from our parents, and they got it from their parents, and they got it from their parents. So it's a fundamental root of our identity. Mm-hmm. Everyone is curious about it. Everyone knows something about it, but a lot of people don't exactly know how it works, and we hope that the app can help explain some of that mystery.
Yeah. For instance, we cannot make you Spider-Man.
No.
Which is often the questions you get when people hear you're studying genetics. Like, oh, can you clone me?
Yeah.
Oh, can we get superpowers? Because everyone's heard of CRISPR and then you can gene edit your genes. So the questions arise from that. So I think there are a lot of misconceptions as well regarding the genetic technology that currently exists.
Another big genetics misconception, according to DeRosha, is that DNA among various ethnic groups is different, and therefore people think it should be classified differently and according to that classification. But he says this could not be any further from the truth. And in the following insert, he goes into how your genes create their own path.
Basically, the combination of genes you inherit from your parents matters as well. So we all have two copies of each gene, effectively. Sometimes genes that work will override the others. Sometimes genes that don't override and form their own trait. So depending on which ones you inherited from your parents, the pattern defines what you will experience.
And this is explained in the inheritance.
Instance patterns. Yeah. So one of your parents either has that, and you'll ask them, can you taste this? Did you taste it this way? If they don't, that just might mean that they're hiding the one that lets them, but they pass that respective one down.
Hayat and Darosha explained that sometimes not all that we are told is true, and that just because cancer runs in the family does not necessarily mean you will develop cancer in your lifetime. And because a number of variables such as diet, environment, and upkeeping, among many other things, determine what the general well-being of an individual would be like. And this, he goes into what are the many other factors that could contribute to one's well-being.
A lot of people think that their genetics gives them an innate resistance to cancer and other types of diseases. So people will say, I can smoke, my grandmother smoked and she lived till 90. But absolutely, those are fallacies. People believe that they have strong DNA, but the risks are always there. Mm-hmm. Your own DNA may not reflect what they had. You've inherited different copies, different traits, different combinations, so you can't get around that.
Yeah, that's because certain diseases are polygenic, meaning there are multiple genes that affect the development of a disease. Mm. So just because your parents did not have cancer doesn't mean you cannot get cancer at all. And vice versa, just because your parents had cancer doesn't mean you definitely will develop it.
Yeah.
There are many, many factors that affect this.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean you shouldn't look after yourself. You should be vigilant and go for regular checkups. And
a unique trait found in the African population is a condition called brown cutaneous albinism, which is a group of conditions affecting the pigmentation of the skin, the hair, and the eyes. And researchers have identified multiple types of oculocutaneous albinism, let's get that right, which are characterized by their skin, their hair, and eye color changes. And type one of this kind of albinism is characterized by white hair, very pale skin, and light colored irises. Now, baby Sinazo Njingila, who is almost 2 years of age, has some distinct characteristics of type 2 oculocutaneous albinism, and his features are a creamy white color, reddish brown hair, and greenish eyes. And this is his story, told by his parents Sabelo Njingila and Bongeka Zulu.
The eyes are from his side of the family, but the skin color, it's both the family.
My late father and my grandmother both have blue eyes. So the baby takes it from my father and my grandmother. My grandmother is half colored and half Zulu. So it happens with Nobongeka, it's still the same thing, because mother like half colored and half Zulu. So the baby about genetically, it's at my genes. Not just my genes, but my genes are going to be a bit. I mean, it's confusing, it's different. It's how you both don't have green eyes, but how come you can maybe my eyes are going to be maybe like a snake. I get no, it happens with your I'm going to end up saying, this baby can't be yours, why baby? So the baby is mine. It just happens with our baba and because I myself understand with my parents' side, go ganjalo. Because my mother has plain black eyes. From my mother's side, the Abazulu. But from my father's side, we mix. That's why my grandmother has and my eyes are so greenish or bluish. You can't really tell the other because it's mixed green and blue. Yeah, well, and it's exactly like the baby's eyes.
I was only expecting the color, but not the eyes. Yeah, it came as a surprise. Because I was scared, thinking that maybe he won't see or maybe she's blind in the way. And then he had a problem with eyes as well, because I used to use ointments in his eyes all the time.
She also used to send me to, like, she was worried ukuthi umntwana since is so far away with my eyes akhe yonke lonto, maybe the baby's gonna maybe turn blind or maybe something bad ekuzwenzeka emihlweni. Can I always used to tell her ukuthi na give it some time. Now when I was still a baby, I used to suffer with my eyes, and umntwana uzoba right amehlo. Because I knew good from before he was born, good. I was expecting good his eyes are good. Because my older brother, he was in Lady Smith, who is dark in complexion, but the baby has similar eyes, like how my baby does.
Type 3 includes a form of albinism called rufous oculocutaneous albinism. It's the most common albinism we are mostly exposed to, which usually affects dark-skinned people. And affected people have reddish brown skin, ginger or red hair, and hazel or brown irises. Now, type 3 is often associated with milder vision abnormalities more than other forms of this kind of albinism.
Another condition where that is very true is albinism. Big, big myths surrounding albinism in Africa. It's really awful, and we hope to empower people with genetics to understand what's really happening there. Now, albinism, we know very well, is a recessive trait. A recessive trait is where you need two copies of a non-functional gene or altered gene in order for the trait to manifest. Whereas other congenital conditions such as dwarfism are dominant, having only one copy of an altered gene will be enough for that condition to manifest in the child. That's actually how albinism presents often, and parents end up shocked and confused. Two parents with absolutely normal pigmentation will have a child with albinism and then worry, what happened? Was it a mistake? Did I eat something wrong? Is this a curse? Etc. But really, what's happening is they just pass down their respective hidden copy of their genes to this child. And so the trait is manifest in the child, and that's all it is. It's a single gene change in the production of melanin.
Here the pair explains why black genes matter and why there is a need to study African DNA samples to come up with solutions for precision medication.
Why we mainly look at our local genetics, our African genetics, because of the gap in genetic data out there. So any European data or information we have on genetics, such as European, cannot be applied to South African, because our African populations are a lot older and therefore they have a lot more variation.
Just to explain the basis of this, all humans on the planet share a substantial overlap of DNA, but since all humans evolved from African continents and left Africa, tribes that have been here longer and have developed in the modern peoples today have maintained their longer sequences, whereas people who have moved elsewhere in the world have picked up mutations, changes, even gotten shorter lengths of DNA compared to what we see in Africa today.
The most well-studied populations in the world are Europeans, and because a lot of money and research has been pumped into studying these groups, which is why scientists understand their genetic structures better. That's why they understand their genetic structures better, because closely related populations share some variations between each other. However, because genomic studies in African populations have been lagging behind, geneticists have not been able to provide and deliver suitable medication appropriate for African population genetic structures.
A dual disease burden that we're facing right now is, although we have HIV and TB running rampant, we've got heart disease and diabetes and cancer rapidly catching up in killing people and causing health effects. Those are such a strong genetic element that we needed to have started studying these years ago. So we're about to face a new health crisis in South Africa.
And here Daroka takes us through who are the other people involved in how the app was built.
We had two main groups, coding group, which George was in charge of, and the content generation group, which I was in charge of. So all content was created by all members of Scope, which is the students here at the SPIMB, as well as VITS Human Genetics, based at the NHLS in Braamfontein. Yeah. So pictures, words, background, drawings, everything was created by our team. and the coding as well. So George had to, maybe you can elucidate more on how you had to learn HTML5.
It's incredible what you can learn for free on the internet these days. I just went onto some sites and took some courses to learn how to code in HTML5. It's one of the most commonly used languages around the world. It basically encodes most web pages that we interact with today. So learning a bit of HTML5 and CSS, which is a structuring language, I learned how to build up the framework for our information displays that we put into the app. That's what we plug our content pages into to display them nicely on a phone. We then build those codes together into a little package called an APK. We use a tool to do this. It's available through Adobe. It's called Adobe Phone Gap Build, which packs your code together in order for an Android phone to understand it, which can then be put up on the Android store for anyone to download. Easy peasy, install and run.
Lastly, this is what the team hopes for their app.
So the app we've been speaking about this whole time is called Genscope, a play on our own name.
One of our ex-students, Marla, she designed that page as well as our logo.
Yeah, extremely talented artist and geneticist and now data scientist. So Genscope, its basic landing page has a few sections for the user to go through. The basics of genetics, advanced topics, and real-world examples. So if you start off with basics, it asks you the question, do you want to know more about genetics? And you tap on basics. It gives you some more sections to look at, starting with the section titled You. Now, this is a great section because it begins with you. Where do you come from? How did you come into being? And it explains that just like all things in this world, you have to come from parentage. Someone has to create you. And your parents create you by passing down their genetic material, their DNA. And then we break down how we study it. Just like houses are made of bricks and smaller components, our bodies too are made out of cells.
The team is also making a call out to interested individuals who would like to assist in translating this app or the language used in the app, which is English, to various South African official languages. And this is where we leave the story for tonight. And tonight we do not have Unscience because we want to go into the second story in our show. But let us just take a really quick break, and then after the break we will come back with a story that was done by Masibulele Lunika.
This is the Science Inside.
Professor Ngoza Dlova herself said this is probably the biggest breakthrough in South African dermatology. Her groundbreaking study in collaboration with other researchers titled Variant PAD13 in Central Centrifugal Sesotrial Alopecia was published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the highest impact journals in medical science. She elaborates more on this research and what triggered it.
So the skin conditions and hair conditions are common, and I think we observed in the last 10, 15 years that we are seeing a number of patients with hair loss compared to, you know, the early 80s. So what we found in some epidemiological study that we did in KZN, we found that hair disorders were like now in the top 5 conditions that we're seeing, whereas in the past they were not even featuring in the top 10 conditions that we're seeing. So we also started seeing this condition called central centrifugal sesotrial alopecia, which is basically hair loss which occurs on the vertex of the scalp and is seen commonly in African women. So this condition has been described before for a long time. We would tell patients that we don't know precisely what's causing CCCA, as I have described it, as a progressive permanent hair loss condition affecting women of African descent between the ages of 30 and 65. So in the past, they used to call it hot comb alopecia because it was diagnosed in a handful of women, African Americans, I think in 1968. So they attributed it to be caused by the use of a head comb because it was a hot comb. It was used for straightening hair so that it's easy to comb. So when we started seeing a number of patients with this, then we asked ourselves, and I think one or two patients that came to see us And I realized that actually none of them had any history of use of any chemicals or any weaves or any hair extension. So that's what actually triggered the interest. So we did biopsies and then found that all the patients in this family had the same condition.
But does this condition only affect people or women of African descent, one may wonder? And is there any explanation for why that is?
Yes, we haven't, it has not been described in other ethnic groups, mainly individuals of African descent, as to why we still don't know. But we do know that certain conditions occur in certain populations and in certain, among certain genders or certain areas. So we still don't know why it affects African people of African descent.
Of course, this is a groundbreaking discovery for the scientific community and in medicine. Can you just talk us a little bit on what this means for the sciences and understanding this particular condition?
Yeah, well, for us, it's great to know this because, as I mentioned, now instead of seeing these patients with this condition and say, you know, we don't know what's wrong with you, we are seeing it, but we can't, you know, say what it causes. Now we can affirmatively say it is a genetic condition, meaning that it is inherited in certain, it will occur in certain families. And we can also say that because some of the patients that we saw found that those were excessively grooming their hair, you know, relaxing their hair, using weave and braids and pulling their dreads. The condition was much more worse in those people compared to people who had were manipulating their hair less often than those. So what we can say is that for sure it is genetic, and if family members have this condition, they need to be extremely careful.
Very interesting, Professor. And I guess the study would not have attracted interest had this condition not been that prevalent. And I'm saying this because I've also encountered it in some of my own family members. The hair loss is quite common in men, but can you just tell us a little bit more about how common this is among African women?
The prevalence is about ranges between 2.7% and 5.6%. It's much more common amongst African Americans. And in South Africa, a study that was done in Cape Town by Prof. Kumalo, it showed about 2.7%.
Now, talking about the treatment available to prevent or cure it, I understand this is one of the first steps to actually finding it, and it may be a bit tough considering that it is, in fact, a genetic condition. But is there any available treatment at this point?
If anyone has got a problem with hair loss, they need to see a hair specialist or dermatologist as soon as possible. Because once you lose your hair, you know, and your scalp is shiny, there's not much you can do because the hair root has been destroyed. So we always treat hair loss as an emergency in a way because we want to abort it and use treatment that can stop the treatment, the hair loss. So if we can, there are certain tablets and medications and creams and lotions that we can use, but those therapeutic interventions will not bring the hair that you have lost back, but it will stop the disease from progression. However, despite using those products, if a person or individual continues to groom the hair in the ways that I have mentioned, then the hair loss becomes more rapid and much more progressive and much more extensive. We are looking at research now to see whether we can find a test to be able to, so that we're able to detect this condition early and possibly look at some form of gene therapy, and hopefully we will get to that stage. Of course, it's a small area and the disease is burned out, and meaning that it's not active anymore, and there's no inflammation. There is a possibility of doing hair transplant depending on the area, on the individual, the certain criteria that you have to meet. Unfortunately, you know, we will be able to actually do hair transplant because we've just gone for the training. We'll be able to assist with that in certain individuals who could be advisable in.
And out of curiosity, does this condition actually lead up to any other additional health risks for individuals affected by it?
There are no health risks really that are associated with hair loss, except that it affects the the person, the individual, psychologically, and it affects the quality of life, because it means the person who's lost the hair has to wear a wig all the time, and they have to camouflage or use dukes to cover, you know, the area of hair loss.
Now, that is certainly good news that there are no additional health risks. Now we chat to Thande Kamngoma, a housewife and a former teacher who has had first-hand encounter with CCCA and was also part of this study, to get a better picture of how this affects women.
Firstly, it's like a bit of a shock, especially if you have had nice hair, you know. Now all of a sudden your hair is falling, becoming bald. Definitely the confidence goes, and obviously now you always have to hide your head. Say, for example, if I'm not at home, I use wigs. But sometimes at home, you just want to be free. But now I've got my little scarf that I use around at home, because even there, I'm not like happy to be seen.
That is Thande Kamngoma, who has had a first-hand encounter with CCCA. And she also said her condition was not as severe and that she managed to get some form of treatment that helped her on her research. Professor Adlova did collaborate with other researchers. She elaborates on that a bit more.
Research of this scale and extent cannot happen without collaboration. And I think diversity in research collaboration is great, because people come from different backgrounds, come up with different ideas. So I'm eternally grateful to my colleagues, Professor Eli Sprecher from Tel Aviv University, who is a dermatologist and geneticist. Professor Amy McMichael, who is a dermatologist, who is a hair guru with a special interest in hair. She's a professor and head of department from North Carolina University of Wake Forest. And of course, my other colleagues who are scientists, Dr. Ofer Sarik, who's also from Tel Aviv. So we coordinated and collaborated with them. I had patients from South Africa, and Professor Amy had some patients from North America, African Americans. And together, we were able to come up with about 60 patients or so that we had analyzed. And I'm also grateful to the patients, South African patients, who agreed to be part of the study, because I think without them, we wouldn't be able to come up with this discovery. And all the support that I got from my department and, of course, from my family and friends.
There we have it for our main story this week, folks. Thank you to Professor Adlova, and kudos on the amazing work. I am Masibulele Luniga.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on the Science Inside.
Welcome back to the Science Inside. And before the break, we heard a story about hair loss, and that was Masibulele's story. And before that, we also spoke about a genetics app that was developed by Wits students. But this is where we leave our content for this week. A big thank you to all of our guests who were featured on tonight's show, including Professor Ngoza Dlova, Dean of the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Maktab Hayat, and George DeRosha from the Wits University. And last but not least, our team behind the scenes is production by Masibulele Lunika, Campion Zarima, and tech by Kutlwano Sirame. You can get our show on podcastjournalism.co.za/science and social media. We are on Facebook as The Science Inside. You can also tweet us at VowFM. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. Good night.
The Science Inside Podcast.